that old water porter up there." This allusion to thunder, all of whose consequences Gavroche, in his capacity as a philosopher of the 19th century, accepted, was followed by a flash of lightning so dazzling that something of it came in through the crack in the elephant's belly. Almost at the same time, the thunder growled, and furiously at that. The two little boys let out a howl and shot to their feet so fast that the netting was almost knocked over, but Gavroche turned his bold little face toward them and took advantage of the thunderclap to burst out laughing. "Steady on, children, let's not bring the house down. Now that's what I call thunder. Fantastic! That was no damp squib. Good for you, Lord. By jingo, it's almost as good as at the Théâtre Ambigu." That said, he put the netting right, gently pushed the two little boys back down on the bed, pressed down on their knees to stretch them out to their full length, and cried out, "Since the good Lord's lighting his candle, I can blow mine out. Children, it's time to sleep. My young human beings, it's very bad not to sleep. It turns you into a smelly arse, or, as they say, out there in the world of grown-ups, it makes your gob reek. Wrap yourselves up nice and tight in your fur coats. It's lights out. Everyone all right?"
"Yes," murmured the elder boy. "I'm all right. It's like I've got feathers under my head."
"We don't say head," cried Gavroche. "We say noggin." The two boys cuddled up together. Gavroche finished arranging them on the mat and pulled the cover right up to their ears, then repeated for the third time the injunction in hieratic tongue, "Get some shut-eye." And with that, he blew out the candle. Hardly was the light extinguished when a weird tremor began shaking the netting the three children were lying under. There was a series of muffled rubbing noises that gave out a metallic sound as though claws and teeth were grinding the copper wire. This was accompanied by all kinds of sharp little cries. The little boy of 5, hearing this racket above his head, and frozen stiff with terror, gave his older brother a dig with his elbow, but the older brother was already getting some shut-eye, as Gavroche had ordered him to do. So the little boy, frightened out of his wits, dared to address Gavroche, though in a barely audible voice, holding his breath in. "Monsieur?"
"Eh?" said Gavroche, who had just shut his eyes.
"What's that?"
"It's the rats," replied Gavroche. And he laid his head back on the mat.
Actually, the rats, which congregated in the thousands in the carcass of the elephant, and which were the live black spots we spoke of above, had been holding back out of respect for the flame of the candle while it was burning. But as soon as this cavern, which was like their city, had been returned to the night, smelling what the good storyteller Perrault calls fresh meat, they had made a mad dash en masse for Gavroche's tent, had clambered to the top, and were biting into the mesh as though they were trying to break through this new style of mosquito net. Still the little boy could not get to sleep.
"Monsieur?"
He started again.
"Eh?"
said Gavroche.
"What are rats?"
"Mice."
This explanation reassured the little boy a bit. He had seen white mice in his lifetime, and he hadn't been frightened of them, yet he piped up again.
"Monsieur?"
"Eh?"
said Gavroche again.
"Why don't you have a cat?"
"I did have one," replied Gavroche. "I brought one back here, but they ate it on me."
This second explanation undid the work of the first, and the little boy began to tremble again. The dialogue between him and Gavroche resumed for the fourth time.
"Monsieur?"
"Eh?"
"Who was it who got eaten?"
"The cat."
"Who was it who ate the cat?"
"The rats."
"The mice?"
"Yes, the rats."
The little boy, appalled at these mice that eat cats, persisted.
"Monsieur, would they eat us, those mice there?"
"Naturally," said Gavroche.
The little boy's terror reached a peak, but Gavroche added,
"Don't be afraid, they can't get in. And anyhow, I'm here. Here, hold my hand. Now shut up and get some shut-eye."
At the same time, Gavroche reached out over his brother and took the little one's hand. The little boy pressed his hand against him and felt reassured. Courage and strength have mysterious circuits. Silence once more settled in around them. The sound of voices had startled and scattered the rats. In just a few minutes they were back and made a mighty racket, but the three little nippers, deeply immersed in sleep, no longer heard a thing. The hours of the night flew by, Darkness covered the immense Place de la Bastille. A winter wind joined the rain and blew in gusts. Patrols ferreted around doorways, alleyways, enclosures, hidden corners, and looking for nocturnal vagrants. Passed silently by the elephant, the monster standing motionless, its eyes open in the dark, looked as though it were dreaming, satisfied with its good deed, and went on sheltering the three poor sleeping boys from the heavens and from men. To understand what is about to follow, we have to remember that at this time the Bastille guardhouse was located on the other side of the square, and that what happened near the elephant could not be seen or heard by the sentinel. Toward the end of the hour just before dawn, a man came running out of the Rue Saint-Antoine, crossed the square, ran round the big enclosure of the July Column, and slipped through the palings of the fence and up under the belly of the elephant. If any light, however dim, had shone on this man, you would have guessed he had spent the night in the rain. He was soaked through. Once he was under the elephant, he let fly with a bizarre cry that doesn't belong to any human tongue, and that only a parakeet could reproduce. Twice he repeated this cry, which might be transcribed as follows, though this gives only the merest idea of how it sounded. Kirikikiyo! At the second cry, a bright, cheery young voice answered from the belly of the elephant, Yes! Almost immediately, the board that closed the hole shifted, opening the way to a child who slid down the elephant's leg and dropped lightly by the man's side. This was Gavroche. The man was Montparnasse. As for the cry, Kirikikiyu, that was doubtless what the boy meant when he said, Just ask for Monsieur Gavroche. On hearing it, he had woken up with a start. He had crawled out of his alcove, parting the mesh a little before carefully closing it again, then opened the trapdoor and come down. The man and the boy silently acknowledged each other in the night. All Montparnasse said was, We need you. Come and give us a hand. The gamin did not ask for further clarification. Here I am, he said. And they both set off toward the Rue Saint-Antoine, from which Montparnasse had emerged, quickly wending their way through the long line of carts belonging to the market gardeners who head for the markets at that hour. The market gardeners, squatting in back of their carts among the lettuces and vegetables, half asleep, buried up to their eyeballs because of the driving rain, didn't even look at this odd pair going past. The ups and downs of escape. This is what took place that same night at La Force. A breakout had been planned jointly by Babet, Brujon, Gulmer, and Thénardier, even though Thénardier was in solitary. Babet had carried out his part of the business that same day, as we saw, according to the story Montparnasse told Gavroche. Montparnasse was supposed to help them from the outside. Brujon, having spent a month in a correctional chamber, had had the time while he was there first to plait a rope, second to perfect a plan. In days gone by, these austere places where prison discipline leaves a prisoner alone with himself consisted of 4 stone walls, a stone ceiling, a flagstone floor, a camp bed, a barred window, and an ironclad door, and was called a dungeon. But the dungeon was judged too horrible. Now the cell consists of an ironclad door, a barred window, a camp bed, a flagstone floor, a stone ceiling, and 4 stone walls, and is called a correctional chamber. A streak of daylight comes in around noon. The problem with these chambers, which as you see are nothing like dungeons, is that they leave a body to ponder when they should be putting it to work. So Brujon had pondered, and he had emerged from the correctional chamber with a rope. As he had the reputation of being extremely dangerous in the Charlemagne yard, he was put in the new building. The first thing he found in the new building was Gulmer, the second was a nail. Gulmer meant crime, a nail meant liberty. It's time we got a better purchase on Brujon. He looked delicate, with his pale complexion and his profoundly premeditated languor, but he was actually a lusty, strapping lad,
well-bred and intelligent, a thief with a melting look in his eyes and an atrocious grin. The melting look was a result of his will, but the grin was a result of his nature. His initial studies in his art focused on roofs. He had caused great progress to be made in the industry of lead lifters who strip off roofing and peel off guttering by means of the process known as cooking with double the fat. What wound up making the moment favorable for a breakout was that roofers were, at that very moment, repointing and relaying a section of the slate tiles on the prison roof. The St. Bernard yard was no longer absolutely cut off from the Charlemagne yard or from the St. Louis yard. There were scaffolding and ladders up there. In other words, bridges and stairways to deliverance. The new building, which was in fact the most decrepit and crack-riddled building in the world, was the prison's weak spot. Its walls were so eaten away by saltpeter that the vaults of the dormitories had had to be completely lined in wood because stones were breaking away and falling on the inmates as they lay in their beds. Despite its dilapidated state, they made the mistake of locking up in the new building the most alarming of the accused, sticking what is known in prison parlance as the hard cases in there. The new building contained four dormitories, one on top of the other, and an attic on the very top known as the Bel Air. A wide chimney, probably left over from some ancient kitchen of the Duc de la Force, started at ground level and passed through the next four floors, dividing all the dormitories in half, like a sort of flattened pillar, before boring through the roof. Gulmer and Bujon were in the same dormitory. They had been put on the bottom floor as a precaution. Chance would have it that the heads of their beds leaned against the chimney flue. Thénardier found himself precisely above them in the attic described as the Bel Air. The passerby who stops at the Rue Culture Sainte-Catherine after the fire station outside the porte cochère of the bathhouse sees a courtyard full of flowers and shrubs in tubs, at the back of which sits a little white rotunda with two wings, brightened up by green shutters, the bucolic dream of Jean-Jacques. Not more than 10 years ago, towering above this rotunda was an enormous black wall, bare and ghastly, which it rested against. This was the wall of the covered way that encircled La Force. The wall behind the rotunda was like Milton glimpsed behind Berquin. High as it was, the wall was overshadowed by an even blacker roof that could be seen beyond it. This was the roof of the new building. You could see four dormer windows there, fitted with bars. These were the windows of the Bel Air. A chimney poked through the roof. This was the chimney that passed through the dormitories. The Bel Air, the attic of the new building, was a sort of great gallery with a steeply pitched roof, sealed with triple grills and with metal-backed doors studded with enormous nails. When you entered by the north end, you had the four dormer windows on your left, and on your right, facing the dormer windows, four good-sized square cages spaced apart and separated by narrow passageways, built out of masonry to elbow height, and the rest out of iron bars right up to the roof. Thénardier had been in solitary confinement in one of these cages since the night of February 3rd. They never did find out how and through whose connivance he had managed to procure for himself and hide a bottle of that wine invented, they say, by Desrues, which has a narcotic mixed in with it, and which the Endormeur gang, the dopers, made famous. There are traitors employed in lots of prisons, half-jailers, half-thieves, who help in breakouts, who sell their disloyal services to the police and make a fair bit on the side out of the rotten eggs thrown in the police wagon. So the self-same night that Petit Gavroche had picked up the two stray boys, Brujon and Gourmet, who knew that Babet had escaped that very morning and was waiting for them in the street along with Montparnasse, quietly got out of bed and started to drill through the chimney flue that their beds touched with the nail Brujon had found. The rubble fell on Brujon's bed without a sound. The squalls combined with the thunder to rattle the doors on their hinges and made an appalling and very convenient racket inside the prison. Those of the inmates who woke up pretended to go back to sleep and let Gulmer and Brujon get on with the job. Brujon was deft. Gulmer was strong. Before any sound had reached the guard, who was lying in a grated cell that looked onto the dormitory. The wall was drilled through, the chimney scaled, the wire-mesh grill that shut off the upper opening of the flue forced, and the two fearsome villains were on the roof. The rain and the wind grew wilder. The roof was slippery. "What a good night for a getaway," said Brujon. A chasm 6 feet wide and 80 feet deep lay between them and the encircling prison wall. At the bottom of this chasm, they could see a sentry's fusil gleaming in the darkness. They tied one end of the rope Brujon had woven in his dungeon to the stumps of the chimney bars they had just twisted off, threw the other end over the encircling wall, leaped over the chasm in a single bound, hung on tight to the top of the wall, clambered over it, let themselves slide one at a time down the rope onto a little roof that abutted the bathhouse, pulled in their rope, jumped down into the bathhouse courtyard, crossed it, pushed open the porter's transom, next to which hung his cord, pulled the cord, opened the porte-cochere, and found themselves in the street. It was not yet 3/4 of an hour since they had gotten out of bed in the gloom, their nail in hand, their scheme in mind. A few seconds later they had caught up with Babet and Montparnasse as they prowled the neighborhood. In pulling in their rope, they had broken it and a bit had remained tied to the chimney on the roof. Otherwise they had sustained no real damage, apart from more or less entirely skinning their hands. That night, Thénardier had been tipped off. They never could shed light on how, and he stayed awake. Toward 1 o'clock in the morning, the night being pitch black, he saw on the roof, in the rain and howling wind, two shadows flit past the dormer window opposite his cage. One of them stopped long enough for a quick look. It was Brujon. Thénardier recognized him, and that was all he needed. He understood. Thénardier, flagged as a killer and held for laying an ambush at night with force of arms, was kept under constant surveillance. A guard, who was relieved every 2 hours, strode with loaded fusil in front of his cage. The bel air was lit by a wall lamp. The prisoner had a pair of irons on his feet weighing 50 pounds each. Every day at 4 in the afternoon, a warder escorted by 2 mastiffs, this was still the practice in those days, entered his cage, deposited by his bed a 2-pound loaf of black bread, a jug of water, and a bowl full of thin bouillon with a few broad beans swimming in it, checked his irons and banged on the bars. This man came back twice in the night with his mastiffs. Thénardier had obtained permission to keep a sort of iron dowel which he used to pin his bread to a crack in the wall, so, he said, the rats can't get it. As Thénardier was kept under constant surveillance, no one had raised any objection to this dowel. Yet later it was recalled that one of the warders had said it'd be better only letting him have a wooden dowel. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the guard, who was an old soldier, was changed and replaced by a conscript. A few seconds later, the man with the dogs paid his visit and went off without noticing anything peculiar except that the tenderfoot was too young and looked like a real hick. 2 hours later, at 4 o'clock, when they came to relieve the conscript, he was found fast asleep, slumped on the ground in a heap next to Thénardier's cage. As for Thénardier, he was no longer there. His broken irons lay on the tiles. There was a hole in the top of his cage, and above that, another hole in the roof. A plank had been ripped off his bed and no doubt carted away, for it was never found. They also seized from the cell a half-empty bottle containing the remains of the laced wine with which the soldier had been knocked out. The soldier's bayonet had disappeared. As all this was being discovered, Thénardier was believed to be well beyond all reach. The truth is that while he was no longer in the new building, he was still in grave danger. He had not yet made a clear getaway. When he had gotten as far as the roof of the new building, Thénardier had found the remains of Brujon's rope hanging from the bars of the chimney pot. But this remnant was far too short for him to be able to escape over the encircling wall as Brujon and Gourmer had done. When you turn out of the Rue de Berlay and into the Rue du Roi de Cécile, you run into a squalid recess almost immediately. There was a house there last century of which only the back wall remains, a genuine hovel wall rising to a height of 3 stories between the neighboring buildings. This ruin is recognizable by 2 big square windows that can still be seen there, the one halfway up closest to the gable on the right, is barred by a worm-eaten joist propped against the wall like an upright beam. Through these windows you could once see a thick, high, dismal wall that was a section of the covered way that surrounded La Force. The hole that the demolished house left in the street is half filled by a rotten paling fence propped up by 5 stone posts. Hidden in this enclosure is a small lean-to of a shack propped against the fragment of the ruin that remains standing. The paling fence has a gate that, a few years ago, was shut only by a latch. It was on top of this ruin that Thénardier lobbed a little after 3 in the morning. How did he get there? That is what no one has ever been able to explain or work out. The lightning must have both hindered and helped him at once. Did he use the roofer's ladders and scaffolding to go from roof to roof, from enclosure to enclosure, from compartment to compartment, to the buildings of the Charlemagne yard, followed by the buildings of the Saint-Louis yard, the encircling wall, and from there to the hovel and the Rue du Roi de Sicile? But there were gaps in this route that seemed to rule it out as impossible. Did he lay down the plank from his bed as a bridge from the Bel Air to the covered way of the encircling wall? And did he then set about crawling on his stomach along the top of the covered way, all the way round the prison as far as the ruin of a hovel? But the wall of the covered way of La Force followed a jagged and uneven line. It had ups and downs. It dipped down at the fire station. It rose up again at the bathhouse. It was intersected by buildings. It was not the same height as the Hôtel Moignon, as on the Rue Pavée. It had sudden drops and right angles everywhere. And then the sentries would have seen the fugitive's black silhouette. On that score, the route taken by Thénardier still remains virtually inexplicable. Either way, flight is impossible. Thénardier, fired by that terrifying thirst for liberty that turns precipices into mere ditches, iron gates into willow fences, a legless cripple into an athlete, a gout sufferer into a bird, stupidity into instinct, instinct into intelligence, and intelligence into genius, had Thénardier invented and improvised a third way out. No one ever knew. You can't always take in the wonders of escape. The man who breaks out, we repeat, is a man inspired. There is starlight and lightning in the mysterious glow of flight. The straining after deliverance is no less amazing than the flapping after the sublime, and we say of a thief who got away, how did he manage to scale that roof? Just as we say of Corneille, how did he come up with the famous line in Horace, he should have died. Qu'il mourut. Be that as it may, dripping with sweat, drenched with rain, his clothes in tatters, his hands skinned raw, his elbows bleeding, his knees torn to shreds, Thénardier had reached what children in their figurative language call the sharp edge of the wall of the ruin. He had lain on it, stretched out to full length, and there, at that point, his strength had failed him. A sheer escarpment, 3 stories high, separated him from the pavement in the street. The rope he had was too short. He waited there, pale, exhausted, despairing of any hope he had had, still covered by night, but aware that day was about to dawn, horrified by the notion that in a few moments' time he would be hearing the nearby clock of St. Paul chiming 4, the hour when the sentry would be relieved, and when he would be found sound asleep outside his cage under the hole punched through the roof. By the light of the street lamps he gazed in stupefaction at the terrible depth of the drop, at the wet black pavement, that longed-for and appalling pavement that spelled both death and freedom. He asked himself if his 3 accomplices in escape had succeeded, if they had waited, and if they would come to his aid. He listened. Apart from a patrol, no one had passed in the street while he had been there. Nearly all the market gardeners from Montreuil, Charonne, Vincennes, and Bercy descended on the markets via the Rue Saint-Antoine. 4 o'clock rang out. Thénardier gave a start. A few moments later, the crazy and confused hubbub that follows the discovery of a breakout erupted in the prison. The noise of doors opening and shutting, the squeal of gates on their hinges, the tumult of the guards, the raucous shouts of the gatekeepers, the jarring of the butts of muskets on the courtyard pavements reached him. Lights bobbed up and down in the barred windows of the dormitories. A torch ran over the attic of the new building, The firemen from the station next door had been called in. Their helmets, which the torch lit up in the rain, came and went all along the roofs. At the same time, Thénardier saw that a wan streak of light was turning the bottom of the sky mournfully white behind the Bastille. He was on top of a wall 10 inches wide, stretched out in the downpour, with two chasms to both left and right, unable to move, dizzy with the prospect of falling and horrified at the certainty of being arrested, and his thoughts, like the pendulum of a clock, swung from one of these notions to the other. Dead if I fall, nabbed if I stay put. In his anguish, he suddenly saw, the street being still completely dark, a man who was sliding along the walls and who had come from the direction of the Rue Pavée stop in the hollow above which Thénardier was suspended, so to speak. This man was joined by a second man who walked with the same cautiousness, then by a third, then by a fourth. When these men had met up, one of them raised the latch on the gate in the fence, and all four slipped into the enclosure where the shack was. They found themselves exactly below Thénardier. The men had obviously chosen the hollow so that they could talk without being seen by anyone going past or by the sentry guarding the gate of La Force a few feet away. We should add that the rain kept this sentry blockaded in his sentry box. Thénardier, not being able to make out their faces, cocked his ear at their words with the desperate attention of a luckless lowlife who feels he has sunk. Suddenly, Thénardier saw something like hope flash before his eyes, for the men were talking slang. The first man was saying, low but distinctly, "Let's beat it. What are we cooling our heels in this hole as he go for?" The second replied, "It's pissing down fit to put out the devil's bonfire. The cops are onto us to boot, and there's a gunner on the lookout. We're going to get ourselves put back in the slammer, killing time. Here, Isikai." Those two words, Isigo and Isikai, which both mean Isi, here, and which belong, the first to the argot of the barriere, the second to the argot of the temple, were beacons of light for Thénardier. At Isigo he recognized Brujon, who was a prowler of the barriere, and at Isikai, Babet, who among all his other trades had been a junk dealer at the temple. The antique argot of the Grand Siècle is now spoken only at the Temple, and Babet was actually the only person who spoke it really purely. Without that Isikai, Thénardier would not have recognized him, for he had completely disguised his voice. Meanwhile, the third man piped up, "What's the hurry? Let's wait a bit. Who's to say he doesn't need us?" At this, which was merely French, Thénardier recognized Montparnasse, whose elegance consisted in understanding all varieties of slang, but speaking none. As for the fourth, he kept quiet, but his vast shoulders gave him away. Thénardier did not hesitate. It was Gulmire. Brujon spat back almost impetuously, though still in a low voice. "What are you yammering on about? The innkeeper wasn't able to make a break for it. He hasn't got the knack. End of story. Rip up his shirt and carve up his sheets to twist himself a hangman's friend, belt a few portholes in the door, cook up some false dog tags, knock up a few open sesames, snip his fetters, chuck his twister outside, lie low, keep under cover. You've got to be smart to last. The old bugger can't have been up to it. He doesn't know how to use the old elbow grease." Babet added, sticking to the classic wisecracking slang Poulailler and Cartouche used to speak, and which is, to the bold, new, colored and risqué slang Brujon used, what the language of Racine is to the language of André Chénier. "Your barkeep must have been caught in the act on the stairs. You got to be one jump ahead. He's an amateur. He's let himself get played for a sap by some flatfoot, maybe even by a stool pigeon. And they've pulled a fast one on him. Cock an ear, Montparnasse. Do you hear all the yapping in the clink? You saw all those fireflies. He's been busted again, so now he'll be doing his 20 long ones. I don't want to get the wind up. I'm no chicken. That's a known fact, but we can't lounge around here all day. Otherwise, they'll have our hides. Don't blow a gasket. Come with us. Let's hit the bottle together." "You don't leave your friends in the lurch," snapped Montparnasse. "I'm telling you, he's been nicked," Brujon persisted. "At the hour that jangles, the innkeeper isn't worth a bent sou. There's nothing we can do about it, so let's make ourselves scarce. I keep thinking some cops got me by the tail." Montparnasse only put up a show of resistance after this. The fact is that the four men, with the loyalty of villains who never abandon each other, had prowled around La Force all night, regardless of the danger, in the hope that Thénardier would pop up on top of a wall somewhere. But the night really was becoming too much now. The rain was bucketing down so heavily it cleared the streets. The cold was creeping up on them. Their clothes were soaked, their shoes had holes in them, and were taking on water. The alarming uproar that had just broken out in the prison meant hope was fading, fear was returning. All this drove them to beat a retreat. Montparnasse himself, though in a way practically Thénardier's son-in-law, gave in. A moment more and they would have left. Thénardier gasped for breath on his wall, like the shipwrecked survivors from the Medusa, on their raft, seeing the ship that had appeared vanish over the horizon. He did not dare call out to them. A cry overheard would mean all would be lost. He had an idea, a last one, a flash of light. He grabbed the bit of Virgin's rope he had shoved in his pocket, after having untied it from around the chimney of the new building, and threw it into the fenced-off enclosure. The rope fell at their feet. "A widow," said Babet, using the Temple slang for a rope. "My twister," said Brujon, using the Barrière word. "The innkeeper's here," said Montparnasse. They looked up. Thénardier poked his head out a little. "Quick," said Montparnasse. "Have you got the other bit of rope, Brujon?" "Yep." "Tie the two bits together. We'll throw him the rope. He'll fix it to the wall. He'll have enough to get down with." Thénardier risked raising his voice. "I'm frozen stiff." "We'll warm you up." "I can't move." "You only have to let yourself slide down. We'll catch you." "My hands are numb." "Just tie the rope to the wall." "I couldn't." "One of us has to climb up," said Montparnasse. "Three stories," cried Drujon. An old plaster pipe that had served a stove once used to heat the shack crept all the way up the wall, almost to the point where Thénardier could be seen. This stovepipe, at the time seriously damaged and split, has long since fallen off, but you can still see a few traces of it. It was extremely narrow. "You could climb up there," said Montparnasse. "Up that pipe?" cried Babet. "What a funny man, not on your life." Using the Temple slang for a child, he added, "It needs a shaver." "It needs a nipper," Brujon chimed in with the Barrière slang. "Where we find a little mite," said Gourmet. "Wait," said Montparnasse, "I know just the thing." He gently opened the fence gate a fraction, checked to see if anyone was passing in the street, carefully stepped out, shutting the door behind him, and ran off in the direction of the Bastille. 7 or 8 minutes went by, 8,000 centuries for Thénardier. Babet, Brujon, and Gourmet kept their mouths shut. Finally, the gate opened again, and Montparnasse reappeared, out of breath and with Gavroche in tow. The rain continued to keep the street entirely deserted. Petit Gavroche stepped into the enclosure and looked at these crooks' faces calmly. Water was dripping off his hair. Gourmet spoke to him. "Nipper, are you a man?" Gavroche shrugged his shoulders and answered, "A kid like yours truly is a proper jock, and jocks like you lot are kids." "This little shaver sure has the gift of the gab," cried Babet. "The Paris kid isn't knocked up out of damp chaff," added Drujon. "What do you want me to do?" said Gavroche. Montparnasse answered, "Climb up this pipe." "With this widow," said Babet. "Then tie the twister," continued Drujon. "To the top of the perch," Babet finished, meaning the top of the wall. "To the pole in the peephole," added Drujon, meaning the cross piece of the window. "And then?" said Gavroche. "That's it," said Gourmet. The kid examined the rope, the pipe, the wall, the windows, and made that inexpressibly scornful sound with his lips that signifies, "Is that all?" "There's a man up there you'll be saving," resumed Montparnasse. "Will you do it?" Brujon added. "Nitwit," replied the child, as though the question was ridiculous, and with that he took off his shoes. Gourmet picked Gavroche up with one hand, dropped him on the roof of the shack, whose worm-eaten boards buckled under the boy's weight, and handed him the rope that Brujon had tied together again in Montparnasse's absence. The gamin headed for the stovepipe, which he could easily squeeze into thanks to a gaping hole level with the shack roof. Just as he was about to climb up, Thénardier, who saw salvation coming at him, bringing him life, leaned over the edge of the wall. The first glimmer of daylight lit up his brow, which was bathed in sweat, his livid cheekbones, his tapered savage nose, his bristly gray beard, and Gavroche recognized him. "Hang on," he said, "that's my father." "Oh, well, can't be helped." And carrying the rope in his teeth, he resolutely began the ascent. He reached the top of the ruin, straddled the wall like a horse, and firmly knotted the rope to the upper crosspiece of the window frame. A moment later, Thénardier was down on the street. As soon as his feet hit the ground, as soon as he felt he was out of danger, he was no longer tired or frozen stiff or shivering. The horrible things he'd just been through evaporated like a puff of smoke. All that strange, ferocious intelligence roused itself again and found it was on its feet and free, ready to forge ahead. And here is the first thing the man said.
"Now, who are we going to eat?"
There is no point in explaining the meaning of this horribly transparent phrase that signifies at once to kill, to murder, and to rob. To eat, real meaning, to devour.
"Let's go to ground good and proper," said Brujon. "Let's wind up quick, smart, and go our separate ways. There was a bit of business in the Rue Plumet that sounded good. Deserted street, isolated house, rotten old gate on a garden, women on their own."
"Well, then, why not?" asked Thénardier.
"Your fairy princess Éponine had a bit of a sniff around," Babet went on.
"And she took Magnon a biscuit," Goulmer chipped in. "Nothing worth knocking off there." "The fairy princess is no dunce," said Thénardier. "But we should go and have a look." "Too right," said Brujon. "We should go and have a look."
Meanwhile, none of the men seemed to see Gavroche, who, while this confabulation was taking place, had gone and sat on one of the fence posts. He waited a few moments, maybe for his father to look his way. Then he put his shoes back on and said, "Is that it? You don't need me any more, men? There you are, then. You're out of the woods. I'll be off. I've got to go and get my nippers up." And off he went. The five men filed through the fence, one after the other. When Gavroche had disappeared at the turn of the Rue des Ballets, Babet took Thénardier aside.
"Did you get a good look at that shaver?" he asked him.
"What shaver?"
"The shaver who climbed up the wall and brought you the rope."
"Not really."
"Well, I don't know, but it seems to me that that's your son."
"Bah!" said Thénardier. "Do you think so?"
And off he went. Book 7. Slang. Origins. Piglicia is a terrible word. It brings a whole world to life. La pègre, the criminal underworld, for which read theft, and la pègrenne, hell, for which read hunger. And so, idleness is a mother. She has a son, theft, and a daughter, hunger. Where are we right now? In the world of slang. What is slang? It is both nation and idiom at the same time. It is theft in its two different species, people and language. When 34 years ago the narrator of this grave and somber tale introduced a slang-speaking thief in the middle of a written work with the same aim as this one, there was amazement and uproar. What? The very idea, slang, but slang is ghastly. Why, it's the language of convicts, of galleys, of jails, of all that is most abominable in society. And so on and so forth. We have never understood this kind of objection. Since then, two powerful novelists, one of whom is a profound observer of the human heart, the other a fearless friend of the people, Balzac and Eugène Sue, having got crooks to talk in their native language, just as the author of Le Dernier Jour d'un Condamné had done in 1828. The same complaints were made. They kept repeating, "What are these writers trying to do to us with this revolting patois? Slang is vile. Slang makes you shudder." Who denies it? Of course it's all true. When it comes to probing a wound or sounding an abyss or society, since when has it been a crime to go too far, to descend to the very depths? We have always thought that this was sometimes an act of courage, and at the very least a simple and useful activity, worthy of the sympathetic attention that duty accepted and performed deserves. Not to explore everything, not to study everything, to stop en route, what for? Stopping is up to the probe, and not the prober. Certainly, to go poking about among the dregs of the social order, where the ground ends and the muck begins, to ferret around in these muddy waters, to pursue, seize, and dash on the pavement still throbbing, this abject idiom, streaming filth thus exposed to the light of day, this pustulous vocabulary, each word of which seems like an obscene ring of some monster of the slimy deep, is not an attractive task, nor an easy one. Nothing is more disheartening than contemplating the awful teeming of slang thus laid bare by the light of the mind. It does indeed feel like a sort of horrible animal of the night that has just been dragged out of its cesspool. You think you see some hideous bush, alive and thorny, rustling, stirring, whipping around, trying to crawl back into the shadows, menacing and watching. This word here is like a claw, this other one is like a dead eye, bleeding. This phrase seems to pinch like a crab's pincers. And all of it is alive, with the awful vitality of things that have organized themselves in the midst of disorganization. Now, since when has horror ruled out study? Since when has disease chased the doctor away? Just imagine a naturalist who refused to study the viper, the bat, the scorpion, the scolopendrid centipede, the tarantula, who chucked them back into their gloom with this, "Yeek, that's so ugly." The thinker who turned his back on slang would be like a surgeon who turned his back on an ulcer or a wart. He would be like a philologist hesitating to examine a linguistic act, a philosopher hesitating to scrutinize an act of humanity. For those who don't know, it must be told, slang is both a literary phenomenon and a product of society, all in one. What is slang? Strictly speaking, slang is the language of destitution. Here, you might stop us. You might generalize the facts, which is sometimes a way of attenuating them. You might remind us that all trades, all professions, one might almost add all accidents in the social hierarchy, and all forms of intelligence have their slang. The shopkeeper who says, "Montpellier available, Marseille good quality." The stockbroker who says, "Carryover rate, premium, end current account." The gambler who says, "A run of three sees you out, spades it is." The bailiff of the Norman Isles who says, "The enfeffer who closes on his property cannot claim the fruits of this property during the seizure of the immovable property of the defaulting tenant." The vaudevillian who says, "They baited the bear, for they booed the play." The actor who says, "I was a flop." The philosopher who says, "Phenomenal triplicity." The whale hunter who says, "There she blows, there she breaches." The phrenologist who says, "Amativeness, combativeness, secretiveness." The foot soldier who says, "My clarinet for his musket." The horseman who says, "My Indian chicken for his horse." The fencing master who says, "Tierce, cart, break." The printer who says, "Let's use boldface." All of them, printer, fencing master, horseman, foot soldier, phrenologist, whale hunter, philosopher, actor, vaudeville writer, bailiff, gambler, stockbroker, shopkeeper, all of them are talking slang. The painter who says, "My dauber" for one of his art students. The notary who says, "My puddle jumper" for his office boy. The wig maker who says, "My gopher" for his assistant. The cobbler who says, "My tinker" for his journeyman are talking slang. At a pinch, and if you really want to push it, all the various ways of saying left and right are slang. From the sailor's port side and starboard, to the stagehand's court side, stage left, and garden side, stage right, and the beadle's epistle side of the altar and gospel side. There is the slang of stuck-up little mesdames, just as there once was the slang of the précieuses. If you like, you could say the Hôtel de Rambouillet meets the Cour des Miracles. Duchesses have their slang, too, as is attested by this sentence that occurs in a love letter written by a very great lady, and a very pretty one, of the Restoration. "You will find in such palaver a spate of reasons why I should want to fly the coop. For you will find in that gossip many reasons why I wish to free myself." Diplomatic ciphers are slang. The pontifical chancellery, in saying 26 for Rome, Gurkhas Tingzel for dispatch, and Abfuxus Grinagrexutu, 11, for Duke of Modena, talks slang. The doctors of the Middle Ages, who, to say carrot, radish, and turnip, said opoponac, perfuscanum, reptitalmus, tricatholicum, angelorum, postmegarum, were talking slang. The sugar manufacturer, who says low-grade beet. Cone, refined, crushed, lumps, molasses. Coarse, unrefined, over-refined, loaf. This respectable manufacturer is talking slang. A certain school of criticism of 20 years ago used to say, half of Shakespeare is wordplay and puns, and was thereby talking slang. The poet and the artist who, with profound significance, would label Monsieur de Montmorency a bourgeois for not being au fait with verse and statues are talking slang. The classics academician who calls flowers flora, fruit pomona, the sea Neptune, love a flame, beauty charms, a horse a steed, the white or tricolor cockade, the rose of Bellona, the tricorn hat, the triangle of Mars, that classics academician is talking slang. Algebra, medicine, and botany all have their slang. The language employed on board ship, that admirable language of the sea, so perfect and so picturesque, spoken by Jean Bart, Duquesne, Suffren, and Duperré, and that blends with the whistling of the rigging, the noise of the bullhorns, the clang of the scuttling axes, with the rolling, with the wind, with the squalling, with the cannon, is one great, heroic, dazzling form of slang that is to the fierce, unflinching slang of the underworld what the lion is to the jackal. Granted. But whatever you may say, this way of understanding the word slang is an extrapolation and one that not everybody would even accept. As for us, we hold to the old precise meaning of the word, which is circumscribed and specific, and we limit slang to slang. True slang, slang par excellence, if those two words can be coupled together, that immemorial slang that was once a whole realm to itself, is nothing else, we repeat, than the ugly, fretful, underhand, treacherous, venomous, cruel, sleazy, vile, profound, fatal language of misery. There is, at the extreme of all debasements and all personal disasters, one last form of misery that rebels and decides to do battle with the whole raft of happy facts and reigning rights. An appalling battle where, now cunning, now violent, at once morbid and wild, it attacks the social order through the pinpricks of vice and through the club blows of crime. For the requirements of this battle, misery has invented a language of combat, and that language is slang. To keep afloat and hold above oblivion, above the abyss, if only a fragment of whatever language man has spoken, and which would otherwise be lost, that is to say, one of the elements, good or bad, which civilization consists of and which makes it complex, is to extend the scope of social observation. It is to serve civilization itself. This service Plautus performed, whether he wanted to or not, by making two Carthaginian soldiers speak Phoenician. This service Molière performed by making so many of his characters speak Levantine, and all sorts of dialects. Here objections pick up again. Phoenician, marvelous. Levantine, well and good. Even dialect, all right. Those are languages that have belonged to nations or to provinces. But slang? What's the good of preserving slang? What's the good of keeping afloat slang? To that we will answer in a word. Certainly, if the language spoken by a nation or a province is worthy of interest, there is something still more worthy of attention and study, and that is the language spoken by any form of misery. That is the language spoken in France, for example, for more than 4 centuries now, not only by a form of misery, but by misery itself, all the possible human misery in the world. And then, we insist, studying social deformities and infirmities and identifying them in order to cure them is not a job where choice is allowed. The historian of customs and ideas has no less austere a mission than the historian of events. The latter has the surface of civilization, the struggles for crowns, the births of princes, the marriages of kings, the battles, the assemblies, the great public men, the revolutions in broad daylight, all the externals. The other historian has the internals, the background, the common people who work, suffer, and wait, the downtrodden woman, the child in its death throes, the muted one-on-one wars, obscure ferocities, the prejudices, the accepted iniquities, the hidden repercussions of the law, the secret revolutions of souls, the indistinct quiverings of the multitudes, those dying of hunger, the barefoot, the bare-armed, the disinherited, the orphans, the wretched, and the vile, all the spineless worms that wander about in the dark. He has to descend, his heart full of charity and severity at the same time, like a brother and like a judge, right down to those impenetrable blockhouses where those who are bleeding and those who strike, those who are crying and those who curse, those who go without food and those who devour, those who endure wrong and those who do it, crawl and slither willy-nilly. Are the duties of these historians of hearts and souls lesser than those of the historians of external events? Do you think Dante has less to say than Machiavelli? Is the bottom of civilization, being deeper and darker, any less important than the top? Can you really know the mountain well if you don't know anything about the cave? We must say, however, in passing, that from some of the above you might infer that there is a clear-cut division between the two classes of historian that does not, to our mind, exist. Nobody can be a good historian of the patent, visible, dazzling, and public life of peoples if he is not at the same time, to a certain extent, a historian of their deep and hidden life. And nobody can be a good historian of the inner life if he can't manage to be, whenever necessary, a historian of the outer life. The history of customs and ideas bleeds into the history of events, and the other way round. They are two different orders of fact that match each other, that always follow on from one another, and often generate each other. All the lines that Providence draws on a nation's surface have their somber but distinct parallels down below, and all the convulsions down below produce upheavals on the surface. True history involving everything, the true historian gets involved with everything. Man is not a circle with a single center. He is an ellipse with two focal points. Deeds are one, ideas the other. Slang is nothing more nor less than a changing room where language, having some dirty deed to do, disguises itself. It puts on word masks and rag metaphors. In the process, it turns ugly. You can hardly recognize it. Is this really the French language, the great language of humanity? There it is, ready to take to the stage and give crime its cues, apt to play every role in the repertoire of evil-doing. It no longer walks, it hobbles. It limps on the crutch of the Cour des Miracles, a crutch that can metamorphose into a club. It goes by the name of vagrancy. All the specters, its dressers, have tarted it up with makeup. It drags itself along and rears its ugly head, twin attributes of the reptile. It is now primed for any role, made seedy by the forger, tarnished by the poisoner, blackened with soot by the arsonist, and the murderer applies its rouge. When you listen, from the side of honest folk, at the gate of society, you catch the dialogue of those who are outside. You make out questions and answers. You pick up, without understanding it, a hideous murmur that sounds almost like the human voice, but is closer to some kind of howling than to speech. This is slang. The words are deformed, stamped with some indescribable and fantastical bestiality. You think you are hearing hydras talking. This is the unintelligible in the dark. It screeches and it whispers, rounding off the dying light with an enigma. It is dark in misfortune, it is darker still in crime. These two darknesses together compose slang. Obscurity in the atmosphere, obscurity in deeds, obscurity in voices. Abominable toad language that comes and goes, hops, crawls, dribbles, and wriggles monstrously in that endless gray mist made of rain, night, hunger, vice, lies, injustice, nakedness, suffocation, and winter, high noon for the outcast. Let's have compassion for those so chastised. Alas, who are we ourselves? Who am I who am talking to you? Who are you who are listening to me? Where have we come from? And can we be sure we didn't do anything before we were born? The earth is not unlike a jail. Who knows if man is not an ex-convict of divine justice? Look closely at life. It is so made that you can sense punishment everywhere. Are you what is known as a lucky man? Well, you are sad every day. Every day has its great chagrin or its small worry. Yesterday you were trembling for the health of someone dear to you. Today you fear for your own. Tomorrow it will be anxiety over money. The day after tomorrow, the vicious attack of some slanderer. The day after that, the misfortune of a friend. Then the weather, then something broken or lost. Then some pleasure that both your conscience and your spinal column hold against you. Another time, the course of public affairs. Without counting all the heartaches. And on it goes. One cloud disperses, another forms. Scarcely one day in 100 of unbounded joy and unbounded sunshine. And you are among the happy few. As for other men, stagnant night is upon them. Thoughtful people rarely use the terms the happy and the unhappy. In this world, antechamber of another, evidently there are no happy people. The true division of humanity is this: those filled with light and those filled with darkness. To reduce the number of those filled with darkness, to increase the number of those filled with light, that is the goal. That is why we cry, education, knowledge, science. To learn to read is to light a fire. Every syllable spelled out sparkles. But when we say light, we do not necessarily say joy. We suffer in the light. Too much of it burns. Flames are inimical to wings. To burn without ceasing to fly, that is the miracle of genius. When you learn finally to know, and when you learn finally to love, you will suffer still. The day begins in tears. Those filled with light weep, if only over those filled with darkness. Roots. Slang is the language of those filled with darkness. Thought is moved in its gloomiest depths. Social philosophy is spurred on to its most poignant meditations in the presence of this enigmatic dialect, at once blighted and defiant. It is here that chastisement is visible. Every syllable in it seems to be marked. The words of the vernacular appear in it as though wrinkled and withered under the red-hot brand of the executioner. Some of them seem still to be smoking. A particular phrase hits you like the suddenly bared shoulder of a thief tattooed with fleur-de-lis. Ideas almost refuse to allow themselves to be expressed by these ex-convict nouns. Its metaphors are sometimes so shameless you can feel they have been in shackles. Yet in spite of all that, and because of all that, this strange patois is entitled to its pigeonhole in that great impartial filing cabinet, where there is room for the oxidized farthing as well as the gold medal, and which we call literature. Slang, whether we like it or not, has its syntax and its poetry. It is a language, if by the deformity of certain terms we recognize that it has been chewed up by the outlaw Mondrain. By the splendor of certain metonyms, we can feel it has been spoken by Villon. This line, so exquisite and so celebrated, mais où sont les neiges d'antan? But where are the snows of yore? Is a line of slang. Antan, ante annum, is a word from the argative tune that meant the past year and, by extension, the past. At the time of the departure of the great chain gang of 1827, 35 years ago, you could still read in one of the dungeons of Bicêtre this maxim dug into the wall with a nail by the king of Thunes sentenced to the galleys. Les dabs d'antan trimaient siempre pour la pierre du Cèsre. The old men of yore always slaved away for the stone of the Grand Cèsre. Which means, in the past, the kings always went off to be crowned. In the mind of that particular king, the crown was jail. The word décarade, which expresses the departure at a gallop of a heavy carriage, is attributed to Villon and is worthy of him. This word, which blazes along on all 4 feet, sums up in masterly onomatopoeia the whole of La Fontaine's wonderful line, Si fort chevaux tirent un coche. six strong horses pulled a coach. From a purely literary point of view, few studies could be more fascinating and more fruitful than the study of slang. It is a whole language within a language, a sort of sickly excrescence, an unwholesome graft that has produced a vegetation of its own, a parasite with roots in the old Gallic trunk and whose sinister foliage creeps over the whole of one side of the language. This is what we might call the primary aspect, the vulgar side of slang. But for those who study language as it should be studied, meaning the way geologists study the earth, slang appears as a veritable alluvium. If you dig far enough below popular old French, you find in slang Provençal, Spanish, Italian, Levantine, that language of the Mediterranean ports, English and German, the three Romance languages, French, Italian, and Norman, Latin, and finally, Basque and Celtic, a deep-rooted and bizarre formation, a subterranean edifice built together by all the miserable outcasts. Every accursed race has laid down its deposit. Every torment has dropped its stone. Every heart has given its pebble. A host of souls, evil, vile, or bitter, who have passed through life and vanished into eternity are there, almost intact, and, in a way, still visible, in the form of a monstrous word. Would you like some Spanish? The old Gothic slang is crawling with it. There is bofet, bellows, which comes from bofeton, ventan, window, later ventern, which comes from ventana, gat, cat, which comes from gato, aceite, oil, which comes from aceite. Would you like some Italian? There is spad, sword, which comes from spada, carvel, boat, which comes from caravella. Would you like some English? There is bichot, bishop, rai, spy, which comes from rascal, rascallion, rapscallion, rogue, pilch, case, which comes from pilcher, sheath. Would you like some German? There is kalleur, waiter, kellner, ers, master, erzog, duke. Would you like some Latin? There is frangir, to break, frangere, affure, to rob, fool, caden, chain, catena. There is a word that crops up in every language on the continent with a sort of power and mysterious authority, and that is the word Magnus. Scotland turns it into Mac, which designates the chief of the clan, MacFarlane, MacCallamore, the great Farlane, the great Callamore. It should be noted, though, that Mac means son in Celtic. Slang turns Mac into Mech, and later Meg, meaning god. Would you like some Basque? There's Gaisto, devil, which comes from Gaistoa, bad. Sor Gabon, good night, which comes from Gabon, good evening. Would you like some Celtic? There is Blavin, handkerchief, which comes from Blavet, gushing water. Menes, woman, in a bad sense, which comes from Menec, full of stones. Baron, stream, from Baranton, fountain. Gopher, locksmith, from Goff, blacksmith. Gedouz, deaf, which comes from Gendou, white-black. Would you like some history, finally? Slang calls the coins known as écus les Maltese, or Malteses, in a nod to the coinage that was current on the galleys of Malta. Apart from the philological origins we just mentioned, slang has other, even more natural roots that spring, so to speak, from the very mind of man. First, the direct creation of words. This is where the mystery of languages lies. To paint with words that have, we know not how or why, images. This is the primitive foundation of every human language, what we might call the bedrock. Slang is riddled with words of this kind, words that are immediate, out-and-out inventions, from we know not where nor by whom, without etymologies, without analogies, without derivations, solitary words, barbarous, sometimes hideous, that have a rare expressive power, that are alive. Executioner, le tol. Forest, le sabri. Fear, flight, tough. Lackey, le larbin. General, prefect, minister, pharos.